is all part of the show, you know.
Everybody's right, here we are. Coffee is here, everything's good.
Shirley Smart, hello and welcome to the Jazz Podcast. How are you doing?
Hello, I'm very well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me on. It's we're so glad we finally got here because we've been trying to organise this for quite some time.
Yeah. Here we are. I'm your host, Rob Cope. I'll just throw that out there for new listeners. Welcome, new listeners. Welcome, old listeners. We're all here to have a lovely time and celebrate some great news and relax and talk to Shirley. And yes, this is one of the many shows lately that feels like it's been coming for a really long time. I've just edited another show that starts in exactly the same way, where it's like 6 years of toing and froing, and it's like, yes, nailed it. Better late than never. Shirley, we're going to start the show with the track Opals from your album with Robert Mitchell. Is this Zeitgeist squared? Because it's got a little two in the corner, which frightens me.
It was actually Zeitgeist to the power of two. It was a little bit ambiguous, so it was just to the power of two is a bit clunky to write, so we went with the simple. But we liked the idea of that because obviously we're both, there's two of us, it's a duo, so there's two of us. And the whole album came about because I worked with Robert on a work of his called Invocation, which is a huge piece he did. And I helped him with the string parts, and we had a lot of conversations about our respective journeys with improvised music, classical music, and so forth. So it seemed a fitting title. But it's Zeitgeist to the Power of Two.
Oh, wonderful. Well, listeners, let's check it out. This track is Opals. What a beautiful track that is. It's gorgeous. I don't know what I was expecting when I pressed play on it, but I was taken aback immediately by the beauty of the whole thing. Congratulations. Such a lovely album, piece of music.
Thank you. That's quite an eclectic mixture of stuff on that album.
Yes. It's got some great track names as well, like Klavierstück in A.
Ah, yes. That's a random piece of CPE Bach. That we put in. Again, we both had somewhere in the distant past a classical background, and we've both sort of gone in very, very different ways into improvised music. But we both still, I think, had this somewhere in the back and distant beyond of classical music, there is a lot of improvisation, and there really is. Robert was fascinated also by left hand piano. He does a lot of work on that, and this was a particular piece written for either hand to play, so it's basically for one hand of the piano, and we sort of took it and treated it almost like a partimento, which is sort of a single line that you then realize into a piece of music. So we just did that, and obviously we used both hands, weren't that literal about it, it was a lot of fun doing that.
Wow, that's really cool. What an interesting thing to jump into. The avoidance of chord symbols always makes me quite happy as a way of approaching improvisation.
Yeah, I mean, this came from, I suppose, a tradition more based on, it would be figured bass, before the advent of chord symbols at all. They're a bit of a later invention, but Baroque counterpoint, the idea of thinking of a chord is a much later thing. There's a really interesting chapter in a book by Charles Rosen called The Classical Style, where he talks about this switch between as one of the main stylistic developments between the Baroque era and the Classical era, of thinking of the chord as the basis of a composition rather than lines and counterpoint.
Right,
and
right.
It's a really interesting conceptual shift. And actually, chord symbols, Roman numeral chord symbols as a theoretical thing came a bit after that, and as a result of that switch, I think. But Baroque music is completely based on figured bass and contrapuntal lines. And actually, there's this whole tradition that I'm doing quite a bit of work on at the moment called Partimento, which is basically a bass line and no figures. So you have to work out the harmony as well. It's fascinating.
Wow, that sounds incredible. Mm. What an interesting field that you've spent that time in. I do a lot of teaching, and like, for me, grade six theory is like introducing students to figured bass, but that's kind of my experience of it, is more in education than in like practical. But I always admire so much how old it is, and yet it's pretty much what we're doing now, you know, yeah, for the most part.
I'm sure you probably may have a shared view on this, but I teach some figure based stuff as well. And I know how the way I learned it and was taught it was very sort of theoretical and written. And I always struggled with it at the time. I found it really hard. And then as soon as I got on, I got myself in a panic when I suddenly had to teach it. And I was like, oh my God, I can never do this. I've got to learn how to do it in the next month. And I sat at the piano and suddenly just went, oh, as soon as you play it, it's so obvious what happened. And I say it really revolutionized how I taught it as well. Also for grade six theory, I make students do it on the piano, and we sing it and we do it very practically. I think it really helps them. And quite often we turn the figured bass into jazz tunes as well. So it's,
that sounds so fun.
Yeah, I mean, it very much was. That's why figured bass evolved. It was a shorthand for composers who had to churn out loads of compositions and didn't have time to write them out.
Wow, actually, it's like the early Baroque Hans Zimmer churning out these tunes, you know, and getting the interns to put my notes in.
Yeah, exactly. And it also grew out of a living improvisation tradition. Like, I think all the composed music of the Baroque era, I'm doing quite a lot of work on this Partimento thing at the moment, which is quite a recent discovery. But it really reinforces how much that was a part of Baroque practice, and how kind of compositions almost certainly grew out of this common improvised practice. I mean, a bit like jazz today, I suppose. And figured bass is part of that. It's just kind of quickly jot down some notes to remind you what the harmony is, but it grows out of the living practice. So that's really interesting. And that's why I think both Robert and I on that album keep coming back to that and were searching for it. And then he found this piece, so we used that.
That's so cool. Wow. I think figured bass, for our listeners, if you've been listening and you don't know what it is and you've gone to Google it, that just makes things worse.
Yes.
You just look at it and you're like, oh my, it looks like it's so complicated, and there's so many variations and unwritten rules that you could never possibly figure out. But like you say, it surprised me when I started digging into it that it's actually really simple. But then if it wasn't, why would it have ever caught on? Like, if nobody understood it.
Exactly. I mean, basically all the figures, I'm assuming that our listeners have some musical understanding along the line, and even if it's in a different field, but basically the numbers tell you the intervals above the bass. So if you can work that out, it tells you exactly what chord you're playing, and you can convert it into chord symbols very, very easily. I think it has a lot of parallels with how jazz lead sheets actually work. I think it's just a different lot of symbols.
Different lot of symbols. I love it. I quite like grade six theory, the ABRSM version, where it says like you have to harmonize a melody, but it says you can use jazz chord symbols, you can use figured bass, you can just write on the stave. It's quite interesting to see what my students take themselves to if you try and present the three equally, because I love to do that and see what then actually, like you say, when it's like, just, well, it's just intervals above the bass note. It's like, they'll start saying to me, wait, I don't have to write all the notes on the stave then. This is much better.
Because if you've got like a D in the bass and it says 5-3, although in practice it wouldn't say anything because that would just be a root position chord, but then they can decide you've got a D, an F sharp and an A, where do you want to put them? You could have the F sharp at the top, you could have it at the bottom. It creates loads of different spacing possibilities. That's where the music starts and the creativity starts. For me, again, it's very, very much like a jazz chart. Once you know you've got basic chords, but then jazz pianists, I'm sure, will sympathize with this. Most of your life is then spent trying to decide how to voice those chords and like what variations or extensions, how much leeway have you got with that. But the voicings thing is like the whole meat and potatoes of the sound, the realized sound.
Yeah, that's really what it is. Like looking at the chord symbols and understanding them, that's like the easy bit that's a given. And most of what I know about voicings is from Nicky Isles, like little finger for the root note and then thumbs for the third and the seventh. Get your thumbs.
If Nicky said it, you're not going to go wrong.
Yeah, exactly. When she says very something like that, I'm like, yeah, I shall take that to the grave because it's a nugget, an absolute nugget. So, Shirley, tell us a little more about yourself because I've gotten very carried away and excited about all figured bass. And it's amazing to talk to you about it. I feel like I'm learning. I am learning a lot. It makes me equal parts excited and nervous. But tell us about you and what you do.
If this doesn't sound like a very, very strange term, I would describe myself, I suppose, as a jazz cellist. I play a mixed, but in reality, I play quite a mixture of music on the cello. I originally was classically trained, and then while I was at the Guildhall, I heard all these marvellous noises coming out of the bass, out of the basement, and I was kind of like, that all sounds very interesting. What's going on down there? And that was, of course, the jazz department. And I started getting very, very interested in jazz and improvisation, but at that time, it was very difficult to find a way into it. I couldn't find it. It just looked like this very interesting load of stuff going on over there that I don't have access to. And through a large series of accidents, I ended up going to live in Jerusalem for a year. And through another long series of accidents, I met some amazing people over there, got very into North African, Arabic music, Balkan music, which is sort of all the regional traditions, and also met some great jazz musicians. So kind of that brought all of those things together for me. And I suppose what I do now is really a mixture of all of those and everything else I've picked up along the way. I have my own projects and I play, a lot of different other projects, but they're all now, I think, centered around forms of improvised music and improvisation in a lot of different contexts. I suppose is a brief summary of the kind of things I do.
That was a wonderful summary and almost the exact length it took me to go get a cup of tea I'd forgotten I'd made.
One should always have a getting a cup of coffee length summary of everything.
Yeah, that was incredible. I knew I could make it and I just, just took a risk. And it worked great.
Yeah, right.
So that's fascinating that it was a series of kind of accidents that kind of led you as opposed to you forcing it, just happened in its own time. Do you remember a spark in Jerusalem of like a moment where, a tipping point where you'd gone from looking from the outside to being like, I'm in, I get it, I know what I want, or I know how to start?
Blended question, and yes, I do. When I went to Jerusalem, I didn't really have a plan of action. It was just this looks like an interesting thing to do. It's an opportunity that's worked out. I will go and see what happens. So I got on a plane with like one word of Hebrew and a slight amount of apprehension, and thought, the worst case scenario is I don't like it and I get on a plane and come home. And during the first few months, I met, how did I meet them? I met another English girl, actually, after I'd been there for a few months. I met another English girl in the cafe at the Rubin Academy, which is where I was nominally studying, although what I was in fact doing was just going off travelling and turning up for chamber orchestra rehearsals once a week was what, in fact, I was doing. But anyway, I heard this English accent in the coffee shop, and I went to talk to the girl, and her name was Anita. She was actually teaching in Ramallah in Palestine, and she said, we're looking for a cellist for our string quartet. Would you be interested? And I said, yeah, that'd be great. So I went and met, there was quite a lot of English people teaching for the Palestinian National Conservatory of Music, and I started teaching for them and working for them. And we had this little string trio, which then started playing in a Russian mafia-led bar in Jerusalem, in West Jerusalem, on the Israeli side of things. And I was playing Hubert string trios, and this guy came up to me in the middle and said, would I be interested in playing some Moroccan jazz? And I thought, I have no idea what you're talking about, what is going on here. But I went off with him after the gig and basically joined this band. And I was playing some fantastic jazz musicians in it. We were all learning this North African tradition called Shabi. and various other things as well. And basically, that's how I got into it all. And I started playing with a lot of different bands, a lot of different trios. And as I started, I was having a coughing fit.
You're hiding it very well.
Thank you. As I got more into especially classical Arabic music, obviously the tuning systems are really different, and the whole way you produce the sound and kind of move on the instrument is really different. But I think because I was learning it sort of by accident and not with no real intention to learn it, I didn't notice till about I'd been doing it for about 4 years. I suddenly was sitting at home practicing, and I looked at my left hand and went, "Oh my God, like what has happened to my left hand? Why is it at that angle on the string? Why are my fingers moving like this?" And I suddenly realized I'd developed this whole new cello technique without really thinking about it.
Wow. It boggles my mind. That's incredible that you learned it without really doing it consciously.
There was never a moment where I went, right, I'm now going to learn Arabic music. And I, there are a lot of different questions about possibilities and limitations of learning different cultural musics and stuff like that. But I didn't really think about that at that time. I didn't even know those questions existed. It was just like, oh, that's interesting. Why don't I go and find out what that is about? And, you know, playing with the people, playing with musicians, copying what they did, basically almost learning like a child learns, just copying what they did. But obviously what I had that a child doesn't have is I already had a system of playing, because I knew how to play the cello more or less, so I had to adjust what I had. So maybe that's a difference that you don't have when you're a child learning, because you don't already have a system in place. So I suppose it's I've likened it before in some of my academic work to learning a second language, or the difference between growing up as a bilingual, for example, and learning a second language a bit later in life, is that you are very, very likely to adjust what you already know rather than learning from scratch. So it's a slightly different learning process, I think.
Right.
If that makes sense.
It makes complete sense to me. This is how I teach bass clarinet to students who already can play like B-flat clarinet, tenor saxophone. It's like, you can't start from the beginning because you'll never get any good. Everything you already know has got to come together right now to help you jump as many skips, as many steps as you can, you know?
Completely. And using transferable skills and adapt, like what this thing doesn't work. This is going to be a different thing, but there are many sort of steps you can use on what you already do know to help you on the learning process. For me, I think that's a really important learning tool.
Yeah, we just run out of time otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not practical. And you learn when you're a child and you don't have anything else in your mind almost, or you just have like your raw instincts and you always have stuff in your mind. I'm not a believer in the blank slate model of the brain, but you don't have an already established system that you've learned, so there is nothing to conflict with it. So you don't have that process to go through, which I think when you learn a bit later, whether it's in your teens or as an adult, you have habits of thought, of practice, of doing things, and they will have to be loosened and adjusted. And for me, that is the core of the learning process when you are not 5 years old. But most of your life, you're not 5 years old, so I think it's quite an important one.
Great one, isn't it? Great one. It says a lot about someone. I remember starting the flute, and my teacher, Jim Muirhead at the time, very wisely, I was 18, and Jim said, just remember, you're going to need to be okay with being a beginner again if you're going to get any good. And it was great advice. It wasn't like a lecture. It was just a gentle, like, hey, you know, like exactly like you said, it's a life skill in itself to be able to be learning as an adult, or to accept someone else's wisdom, I think.
Totally. Or to take a step back from what you know in order to learn what you don't know. And to see how you can use what you think you know, or the habits that you have and the skills that you have, how can you use them for the new thing? But you have to give space for that to work, I think. I'm sort of thinking off the top of my head a bit here. But I think there's really a lot in that. And there's a process like cognitive. I mean, I know the phrase cognitive dissonance is probably one that is very well known. But for me, that is actually a process that you go through, is some element of cognitive dissonance where you have the new stuff that you don't know, probably clashing a bit with the old stuff that you thought you knew, and having the strength to work through and the patience to work through that, for me is a really important part of that process. But it involves taking a step back and going, okay, I don't know about this.
So with the Arabic music, the harmony and the scales, everything is different.
Well, fundamentally, there isn't any harmony in Arabic music. I mean, harmony is a as I'm sure you well know, basically a 17th, 18th century European evolution. I'm not going to get into it. It's an invention that then got plonked onto everybody else. This is not my way of thinking about it, but it evolved very naturally in Western Europe out of counterpoint and gradually, and also out of equal temperament. I mean, equal temperament was almost designed to facilitate the vertical dimension of music and harmony. And I mean, Arabic music is a huge range of things, but what it isn't is tempered. Like, none of the scales are tempered, so all the intonations are slightly different, and a lot of the scales have, I mean, we can call them quarter tones, but actually in reality they're not quarter tones, they're all slightly different. And Arabic music, Turkish music also have two different tuning systems, so the same scale, or what looks like it's the same scale, is not quite the same in both of them. And then there's as you go across North Africa, like Algeria and Morocco, is a very different sound altogether, and they use slightly different makams or scales. And sometimes also that it's not just the scale, it's the way the scale is realised, the way melodies are constructed. So yeah, but fundamentally, like especially Arabic and Turkish music, the microtones in those scales mean that harmony is just sort of, you have to be really careful if you introduce it. Because some people have done it quite well, is to bring that into jazz, but you just have to have a pianist who is very sensitive of when to leave, especially thirds, out of chords, like more open voice spacings and stuff. So it's doable, but you have to be careful with it, I think, because they're fundamentally not tempered scales, so the tuning is different and it's all linearly conceived, so basically there is no harmony. And that makes bringing harmony into melodies sometimes quite interesting, because syntactically it doesn't work, because the melodies aren't conceived with a harmonic syntax underneath, so you don't get these kind of nice regular four-bar phrases. You get phrases that are sometimes, I don't know, 4.5 bars long, and there'll be a random 2-4 bar in for no good reason except that it fits with the words or the melody. It's quite interesting, sort of juxtaposing them.
It's like the whole different way of thinking to how we approach, you know, depending on your compositional. And I've tried really hard to get away from this year. Like, I look back on old compositions where I've done forms like AABC. There's no place for a C section, except that I panicked and thought there had to be one.
Yeah.
So there's not even a melody in it. I've just written chord symbols. But I didn't have the openness in my mind to think, just cut it out. It just doesn't, you know, it's very hard when you're trained with Western classical music to let go of all the structures that we're given, I think.
I think perhaps that's something as well. I'm going to stick my neck out slightly, that sometimes institutions, I can say this now, institutions can be very, can play a role in consolidating that view. And you know, I think it's great when one has a really good training and you are familiar with traditions and you know stuff really, really well. That is never going to go to waste. But it can also, the knock-on effect of that can create a kind of conservatism. You know what I mean? Or it has to be like this. And if it's not, or there are certain, like, you have to show that you can do this in order to count as a musician. And you're like, yeah, but I don't want to do that. I want to do this. And there's definitely a tension there, I think. But I don't know how to resolve it myself, because I value that training and, you know, all that knowledge a lot. And I think that that's part of what people go to institutions for, is to have that. But maybe there has to be a bit more place where you are allowed some creative agency or some individual agency in that yourself. I suppose Debussy put it really well once. He said, I don't compose in the fugal style because I know it.
Wow, that's a great and scary thought.
Yeah, actually, yes, it is. And then the thought that Bach could improvise a 4-part fugue is quite terrifying when you think about it. But yeah, I think there's an element of that I think we all have, is letting go of the things that you have been taught are so completely fundamental to something. I remember actually once I went to visit my friend Omri, who runs a music shop in Kilburn, and I was just like jamming around playing some, and he's Israeli, so he knows all this music and he understands the world. And I was playing, just sort of jamming around on Makam Bayati, which is one of the quarter tone makams, and we were just having a little jam in the shop, and this guy walked in. And man, he started ranting at Omri in Hebrew, because what he didn't realize is I understood every word because I speak Hebrew. And he was just ranting, he can't play the cello like this, it's out of tune, and rah, 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 and the bow's all in the wrong place. And I just turned around to him and said, mate, do you know anything about Arabic music? He shut up. This is quite a funny moment.
That's so great. So much good about that. That's brilliant.
He was a member of the Israeli Philharmonic Orchestra, this old, kind of old school Russian guy. And I'm sure, you know, he's a great cellist in that vein. Because, you know, the Russians are heavily trained and they are great musicians and they know their stuff generally. And anyone who's in the Israel Phil can play the cello in that way. But what they probably can't do is play it in this way, especially if they don't want to and have that attitude to it. That's what I find disturbing sometimes, is that attitude. It's like, how can you say something is wrong when you don't actually know anything about it and you don't understand that world? You have no right to say that.
Yeah, that's really stupid. But it's also comes it's stupid. It comes from a place of fear. You're doing something that somebody else can't, therefore it must be wrong. Because if it's right, then they have to accept that they can't do it.
And it brings up their own limitations and sometimes perhaps an assumed sense of superiority, which I have to say, and I don't like to say it, but I do find exists in the classical world quite a lot. Of course, an awful lot of people who don't have it, but it is something I have encountered quite a lot, and I don't like that. Especially when, you know, there were certain attitudes towards jazz, and you're like, these people can do something you can't do, even start to do. So I think you should not say that. I think you should just drop it.
Yeah.
Basically.
Anyway. No, I agree. I'm just thinking saxophone's a younger instrument. I think we have that problem less because everyone's collectively experimenting. We're maybe not the best with other. I can't speak for people on the saxophone judging other instruments, but certainly my experience with other sax players, almost 99.9% of the time when you're with another sax player, it's like, have you tried this? Hey, let's try that.
Yeah.
You know, it's still like every 10 years, everyone gets so much better. We understand the instrument more. It's kind of a blessing. I like it.
I think so. And there's that nice kind of pushing each other as well. I've sat in on so many rehearsals and stuff, and you'll see a couple of the horn players in the corner go, oh, look at this exercise. And then they'll be, oh, that's great. I'm going to try that as well. Oh, what about this? And I love that. That's like, that's kind of supporting each other and pushing each other in a really good way. It's a bit like how, like, I think there's a lot to learn from how sports people work in that way. Like, I like watching tennis quite a lot, and I always find it really interesting how they work on a day-to-day basis, because they've got to play each other like every week.
Yeah.
But they also have to deal with, you know, managing life as human beings on a pretty intensive tour, and then coming out onto the court as huge rivals and playing each other. And, you know, how they manage that element of competition psychologically and still be, I mean, Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal are the best example of that ever, because they, you know, they pushed each other so much and they were such great human beings off the court and so lovely and really great friends. And that to me is something really magical.
It's really special. Oh, yeah, I completely agree.
They pushed each other to the limit of what they could do, but they did it in such a wonderful human way as well. And I think, you know, they for me are such a great example of that.
Yeah, mutual respect, and neither one would be as good as they were without the other to push them.
Yeah, and they both acknowledged that, I think, publicly as well. And also now with there's the Russian players, Andrei Rublev and Karen Khachanov and Daniel Medvedev as well. They're kind of the same. They have a really nice vibe, and they've all grown up together since they were 10 years old. And there's something really special about that as well, where they push each other, they play each other every week. And for me, I've learned a lot from sort of listening to interviews with them and how they talk about that and how they manage it and stuff. And I think there's a lot for musicians to learn with that actually as well.
I completely agree. I wished that I had realized earlier. I think I was about 22 before I really realized that the other sax players I know are not my competition. They're my only allies, you know?
Yeah.
They're like, you've got to cling to them. And as soon as I realized that, everything became a whole lot more fun. Like, there's no competition. Everyone's good.
Yeah. Or it's like healthy. If there is, it's healthy. And it's, you know, it's how you manage it and how you channel it, I think.
Yeah, you're right. It is healthy. Because now, like, there's a lot of saxophone players I'll sit next to on a weekly basis. And I'm like, how are you doing that? What's going on there? Why are you so much better than me? Can you please show me what you're doing there? And then you like inch up a tiny little bit like a worm.
It's probably something like someone on the other side of you who wants to ask the same question to you.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, there's some things I can play quite loudly. That's not very useful, but you know.
I don't know. Sometimes there's nothing quite like a really good bit of tenor shredding. I love it.
Quick question. When you play Arabic music on a cello, do you retune the strings to make your life easier?
No. I experimented with that for a little bit. And I know that like Egyptian violinists mostly tune the instrument in fourths. So we usually either tune it G, D, E, A, E, A, or sometimes A, D, A, D. But they tune the instrument in just double fourths. And it's mostly because the way the makams are built is on tetrachords, actually. So it sort of fits under the hand and it makes sense. And I messed around with that with the cello, and you can tune the A string down to G, but bringing the C up to D is a really, it's too much string tension, so it just doesn't really work.
That would make me nervous.
Yeah, I can feel it. And C strings are just a little bit too much, too expensive to do that with. It also didn't sound very nice. So I sort of left it and just adjusted my existing technique to fit it. I didn't retune the instrument.
Right. Next quick question. Did you experiment with playing other types of string instrument, or do you exclusively use your cello?
I have been known to use the violin occasionally, and I sort of have taught beginning violin up to about grade three. But this is such a bad idea. I have to concentrate so hard. When I can play it, if I sit it on the knee, and actually the Algerians play the violin like this, sitting on the knee holding it like a cello with a German bow hold.
Right.
Oh, and it's fascinating because it's a completely different sound. It's really earthy, very, very beautiful sound. But if I have to hold it under the chin, I have to concentrate so hard. I experimented a little bit with a buzuk, which is a Turkish instrument. It's a kind of long-necked, plucked stringed instruments, and I really liked playing that, and I would like to get one actually, and I would like to learn a little bit of oud, but I play the cello, and I adapt things from other instruments onto the cello. And there was a while in sort of jazz context where I realized that basically I was a frustrated bass player and a frustrated tenor player. I was like, I really want to do that. And I thought, it's way too late for me to learn to play the tenor to this level now. I'm not going to do that. And there's like loads of tenor players. There's not many people that can adapt that. So there's a hole there that I can use better with the cello. So that's a far more sensible plan.
That's brilliant. You're right to find out. Mark Lockhart taught me this just when I needed it. Was like, I was doing that thing of melting down about all the things I couldn't do. And he just was like, just ask yourself what you can do. What is it about you that's good that, you know? And that's actually a really valuable lesson for, I think, a lot of musicians.
Yeah, what do you have
musicians.
To bring to the table, and what do you have to give? I think that's a really good thing.
Yeah.
A way of being positively self-critical as well, because, you know, we all are. And it's a natural thing to do, I think, to think of what you can't do is to turn that voice into something constructive and positive.
Yeah. Quick fire round. This is becoming.
Okay.
On the website, album Sextet coming in 23 .. Well, maybe 2024. Working on it. Updates soon. Yes. Do you have any updates for us on the Sextet album?
Not quite. Well, actually, maybe yes. The main issue is that sextets are expensive to record, so there will be crowdfunder coming soon.
Ooh, fantastic.
I've saved some money up, but I think basically I need to do a crowdfunder just to supplement it a bit. And also we need to have a couple more gigs, I think. We've played it in quite a bit. We've got one coming up in Birmingham on the 7th of July. So if any listeners are in Birmingham, come and join us. 1001 Trade. It's for Birmingham Jazz, so we'll be there on the 7th of July. I feel like it just could do with a couple more gigs to play it in a bit more, but I want to get it recorded as soon as possible because I think we've got a really good set, and I love my band. They're a bunch of amazing guys that are just fantastic to work with and such great musicians, so I want to record them.
That sounds brilliant. Let us know when the crowdfund appears because we'll be glad to know about that. And that's a wonderful thing to crowdfund. And I think when you've saved money yourself as well, that's a pretty good start for getting people involved, you know. And there's no funding. There's some, but it's so limited that, you know.
Basically, it's all take it as read that you're going to do it yourself if you're going to do it.
Oh, yeah, completely. Completely. Yeah. Next, do you want to share with us the exciting news that you have, or would you rather be completely private and I just edit this bit out?
When does this go on air?
probably in like 2 weeks. Try and do it right.
That's
before
fine,
that
because I'll be out there by now. But yeah, I've
definitely
just,
not before that. So go for
that's
it. Tell
fine.
Us.
I'm going to be going. I just as I was waiting for Rob to open the Zoom meeting that we are talking on, I received an email to offer me a job as academic professor of music, assistant academic professor as of musicianship. And can I say this again? You can add it down. I don't remember what the job
well, it's so new. You've known now for 41 minutes, all of which you spent talking to me.
As soon as this is finished, I'm going to turn off the computer and completely melt down. I've been offered a job as assistant professor of academic musicianship and improvisation at the Royal College of Music, which I'm spectacularly happy about. I've actually been teaching at the junior department for about 14 years and doing musicianship and improvisation, which I've loved. And I'm so happy to be joining the faculty at the RCM in the senior department doing it. So, I'm a bit over the moon about that.
It's stunning. It's so exciting. And it's hugely heartwarming for me when opportunities of this magnitude come along to like deserving people at the right time, and not necessarily like if you haven't got that kind of job by the time you're 25, it doesn't mean you're not going to have these opportunities, you know?
Oh, goodness. Yes, this is another thing. This is another idea that we need a good shredding for. I only went to Israel when I was 25. Nothing, I didn't even, if someone had told me at that point that I would be doing the sort of things I do now, I would have looked as if they just told me I was going to fly to the moon on a banana. I had no clue what they were talking about or what that even meant. So, yeah, I think this is an idea that needs to be put to bed forever.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. Shirley, let's finish this show. Thank you for sharing that news. It's wonderful. If any of our listeners still didn't know, particularly big fans of yours, that's an incredible achievement. And yes, please do turn this off and have a party.
yes, I will be doing that.
Let's finish the show with Klavierstückchen A. Is it pronounced like that? Is it like a German thing?
As far as I know, my German is pretty terrible, to be honest. So I'm assuming that I'm going phonetically with it.
I feel pretty good about my pronunciation. My GCSE German's paying off right now.
But you have more German than me.
let's play this for our lovely listeners. And now you've explained a little bit about the tune to us and about the way it was constructed. So this is Klavierstückchen A, also from your album with Robert Mitchell, who has himself been on twice. So some of our listeners will be very familiar with his work.
Robert and I actually have a gig in July at Crypt in Camberwell.
Oh, brilliant. When is it?
It is. I will just quickly look it up. Can I do a couple of quick gig plugs?
Zoom says less than a minute. On my
28th of July, Robert right. Mitchell and Music Crypt. Go.
Beautiful. Here it comes. Klavierstückchen A. Thank you, Shirley Smart, so much for coming on the Jazz Podcast. It's been an absolute joy.
Thank you, Rob. You're welcome.